The Orb, Volume 1, Number 2. Identity. Hello, welcome to The Orb. My name is Reed Hart. That opening statement is worth taking a look at. Each episode is carefully written, and that statement no less so. Hello, welcome to The Orb. This serves two purposes. The first is a greeting intended to let you know that you're welcome to listen. The second purpose is to create a marker that we're about to get going, a sort of frame that the content fits inside. I'd bet you were a bit startled when you heard it repeated. My name is Reed Hart. Also has intention, and yes, that is my real name. More on that later. You've likely been to more than a few events where the organizer provides an adhesive label with a brightly colored banner outlining white lettering that says, "Hello, my name is..." You're supposed to write in your name, then stick the label on your clothing, typically somewhere below your left collarbone. I really hated those labels. I had to ask myself, why? On reflection, there are three things about them that bothered me. First, simple cosmetics. I arrive dressed in a particular way. Sometimes it's assertive, a white shirt and red tie saying, "I have something to say, so pay attention to me." Sometimes it's a drab outfit, so I can lurk in the background. The sticker says, "Everyone is equal," and works against the role I want to play. Second, first impressions. The way I write my name, a comic script, decorated, sloppy and off-center, or crisp and clean printing, is making a statement about me. The penmanship is conveying something that I may or may not want to convey. It is fixed, regardless of whether it suits the impression I'd like to establish with a particular person. I'd like to have more control over the nature of that first impression, based on what my goals are with the person I'm meeting. I've lost control of that impression by how steady my hand was when I wrote my name. Third, gatekeeping. This is the big reason these labels bother me. I consider my name a part of my identity, my own, to control as I see fit. I can give it away or withhold it. It works like a gift, an offering. When I tell you my name, I'm opening a gate in the barrier that exists between us. More than that, you know that I'm opening that gate. I'm saying that I want to have some interaction with you. You, in turn, can then choose to give or withhold your name. That action tells me that you either want to engage or you want to close the gate. Those labels take away that tool to establish the willingness to engage. I've reached some equanimity with these labels. After all, attendance at the event implies a willingness to engage, at least on the subject of the event. Still, they do great. I use my real name because I don't know just where this engagement may take us. I don't want to start this kind of conversation with a deception that can only hurt my credibility later. There are reasonable arguments for anonymity, or use of pseudonyms. When the speaker is not identifiable, the focus of attention must shift to the content of the speech. Anonymity protects unpopular individuals from retaliation, and their ideas from suppression. The downside to anonymity is that it becomes a shield that enables one to put forward paper-thin arguments or even known falsehoods. Taken on balance, most agree that the benefits of free expression are worth the risks of misused anonymity. The Orb forums post under pseudonyms, usernames, for this very reason. Now we're getting closer to why this episode is called Identity. People pass judgment on what others say, regardless of the speaker's name. That judgment can hurt. Any negative judgment is an invalidation that attacks who we think we are, our identity. I give my real name, because any attacks on the ideas I put forward are not going to affect my sense of self-worth. I'm developing skills to separate my sense of self from the judgments of others. This is the theme of this episode, and will take some time to explain.
If not for you, babe, I couldn't find the door. Couldn't even see the floor. I'd be sad and blue if not for you. If not for you, babe, I'd lay awake all night, wait for the morning light to shine in through. but it would not be new if not for you. If not for you, my sky would fall, rain would gather too. Without your love, I'd be nowhere at all. I'd be lost if not for you, and you know it's true. If not for you, my sky would fall, rain would gather too. Without your love, I'd be nowhere at all. Oh, what would I do if not for you?
Identity can be a really big subject. Humanity has been pondering it for millennia, and there are centuries of literature on it. I can't summarize it all in a 26-minute podcast. I'm really just talking about the stuff that is on my mind, things that affect the quality of my life. To philosophers, identity is a set of properties, lazy, driven, needy, that can change over time. I'm happy that philosophers believe we can change who we are. I know that the person I was at age 9 was me, although my self-concept now bears only a few similarities to that child. If I were to ask you, what makes you so special? You could come up with something. I make the best chili, or I have the worst handwriting. These are examples of how we set ourselves apart from others. We pass judgments on our skills or traits. I'm too lazy, or I'm totally committed, that collectively form our sense of self. So how does identity form? What gives it shape? I have a theory. In the previous episode of The Orb, On Purpose, I talked about having value by virtue of just being. What do we do with that value? We invest it. We sink roots into things that give us a sense of place in the world. Not necessarily geographical place, but a role in society. Some of it is in roles we play as workers, consumers, parents, and friends. These investments form the expression of our identity. The expression is not the identity itself. That is something that forms from our life experience and the influence these events have on us, both consciously and subconsciously. It governs our choices of where we invest ourselves. I witness an event that leads to a result. That, in turn, causes another effect. In this chain, I make judgments. I blame or credit that cause with this effect. It is the sum of these judgments that make me who I am. These events don't have to happen to me directly. They can be something I see in a movie, or read in a book, or a news story, or perhaps something from a dream. Even if I don't have all the facts, I look for patterns and fit the events into a schema that makes sense to me. That schema itself is formed from judgments I've built up over time, of what I find credible, and leaves out things I've deemed unimportant. Most of the time, I'm not really conscious of making these judgments. They are just the way I see the world. People live within a society and move in circles of family, friends, and work associates. Our connections with these people are critical to the quality of our lives. For better or worse, we spend much of our time passing judgment on everyone, including ourselves. We judge something that someone says as hurtful or loving, their actions as competitive or cooperative. To pass a judgment is to wield a knife, to separate one thing from another. Where we choose to make the cut sets us apart. Yet we still need to bond in groups, so we join collections of people that make the same cut we make, political, religious, or cultural, that says this is a good fashion and that is bad. This is a faithful choice and that is heresy. This is righteous and that is sinful. When you encounter someone who makes the same judgment you make, you feel a kinship with that person. You have some shared experience, perhaps by ethnicity, gender, or other physical or social feature. When you see someone who makes a judgment different from yours, you say, clearly he hasn't got the benefit of my experience, so he's made the wrong judgment. If you put yourself in his place, he's saying exactly the same thing about you. That my past is different from yours means my judgments will be different from yours, means I am separate from you. There's nothing to say that one set of judgments is right and another wrong. When we separate the projection and look at the event, there is no right or wrong, just an event. There is no evil, but that we make it so. Only our judgment can define good and evil. We invest ourselves in things, jobs, relationships, nation, community. This is where we store our value. Expressing judgment, making choices, is how we spend that invested capital, that self-worth. If others validate our judgments, we have spent well and feel worthy. If we're criticized or ridiculed, we have wasted some of our worth and feel cheapened and impoverished. Any investment of identity, putting my roots into something, has risks. If that thing I've rooted to suffers any erosion, it kills off a chunk of my identity. I defend my turf in proportion to the level of my self that I have invested in that ground.
Get off my lawn.
How many people can you recall that have lost a job or had a relationship break up and feel they are lost, adrift? They doubt who they are. They still have self-awareness and a personality, but seem to have lost touch with their concept of how to define themselves. How can I protect myself from suffering those losses? I need a skill that enables me to recognize that self-worth, my value as a person, is not buried with those roots. My value does not wash away when my investment erodes. This is not an easy skill to acquire. You pretty much have to die trying. Allow me to explain that. In the 90s, I participated in a series of seminar workshops on perspective and forgiveness. I was introduced to an exercise we called Who? Whenever you find yourself with a negative feeling and wanting to blame someone for it,
he made me so angry, he made me cry, she made me mad.
Ask yourself, who makes you mad? It is your own judgment about him and his actions that have made you angry. Whatever his action, it was just an action. It is the consequence of judging that has made you angry. Own it and forgive yourself. Judgments only separate us from each other and our world. In letting go of our judgments, we have to sever ourselves from our roots, abandon our investments. In essence, what we believe defines us as separate individuals must die. Show of hands, who wants to die? As I said, this skill is very hard to acquire. To not judge does not mean we have no worth, no value. It simply means we do not need to measure our value by expending it publicly. We tend to use the validation of others to remind us that our value is real. The skill is found in remembering that our value is inherent in our being, not in the expression of our separate identity. Coming back to my willingness to put my real name on this podcast, it is my investment, or more precisely, my lack of investment in the righteousness of my perspectives that liberates me. A well-reasoned argument that illuminates a different perspective is something that I can accept without feeling that I have any identity loss. To maintain perspective and healthy connections, you cannot wield the knife that cuts you off from others. The easy way to peaceful relationships is submission. For the sake of our marriage, I'll go along with you on this. That stance allows you to hold on to your judgments, just choose not to act on them. You still seethe inside. It's not a healthy thing. True surrender releases the judgments. The only loser is you. I mean that more literally than you might think. The connection is stronger, so you are not really a loser. What is lost is a part of your identity. You lose part of yourself. To surrender all judgment voids the identity. The self dies. I'm not in any way advocating physical suicide. Quite the contrary. Really living in peace, love, and joy requires killing off identity. That's not an easy thing to do. It's really, really hard. It doesn't happen all at once. It's not an all-or-nothing event. And it's not always forward progress. There are some times that you relapse and you want to wallow in self-pity. You may say that, Although I lost that battle, I stuck to my judgments, and I was right. That righteousness is a delicious thing, even if it means separation and loss from something that may have been important to you. I only ask that you start to recognize when you are making judgments that are causing you pain. If you can surrender the judgment, you'll find that far less painful. Building connectedness is a solo act. As each of us is solely responsible for our judgments, we can only act alone in surrendering them. Where there is a communication breakdown, a wall between you and someone else, it is probably built with the bricks of invalidation. Most of us truly want to help other people, but often we don't know how, or we start giving advice as our parents did to us. You may find that if you surrender your judgment and accept the other person's situation as their own, remember the game of who? They are able to work out their own emotional problems even faster than if you try to advise them. I'm not suggesting you challenge them openly with the question of who and try to get them to own the responsibility for their feelings. That is likely to just build hostility. It is essentially telling them that they're approaching the problem the wrong way. What I'm suggesting is that you give them space to be who they are, and most importantly, don't try to make them wrong for feeling the way they do. They aren't wrong. They just experience the situation differently from you. Let them. Now, I'm about to make one of those stereotypical statements that leads to conflict because it's judgmental. See, I'm not all the way there yet either. I'm going to say this because it's a broadly true observation that illustrates the point. When it comes to validating someone, guys are really bad at it. Guys tend to be Mr. Fix-It. When someone complains of feeling badly about some situation, guys want to fix the situation, thinking, if I can fix the cause, that will fix the effect. We're so wrong. When someone is responding emotionally to an event, it's too late to change the event. What is needed is to validate the person's sense of self, to allow them to be judgmental and not make them wrong for the judgment they've made. Basically, all you need to do is not judge either the situation or the feelings. Remember that your projections on that event are not the same as those of the person struggling. Anything that sounds judgmental is going to be heard as an attack on their identity. There's nothing to fix. Stop judging. When we take the time to reflect on ourselves, we can become pretty uncomfortable. We judge ourselves against our ambitions and usually come up wanting. The emotional response to the judgments we make often lead to the desire to
make it stop!
We turn to escapes like television, video games, or even recreational drugs. Then again, some turn to these same things to increase their self-awareness, to introduce new perspectives and projections to judge against. Self-awareness is also heightened by situations like seeing yourself in a mirror, being videotaped or recorded, or standing in front of an audience. The anxiety experienced in these situations is related to your judgments of yourself. If only we could let go of these judgments, we could let go of that anxiety. You're likely familiar with what is known as illusory superiority, that people tend to rate themselves above average in most things. Driving skill, leadership ability, getting on well with others. Nice things like that. We only tend to underrate ourselves at less common, more challenging things like juggling or riding a unicycle. Studies suggest that we don't objectively rate our own abilities, behaviors, and characteristics. Instead, we have what the studies describe as an automatic tendency to assimilate positively evaluated social objects toward ideal trait conceptions. Essentially, we judge ourselves by what we think we can do, our potential to achieve our ideal self-image, whereas others judge us by what we have done, our real accomplishments. In Batman Begins, Rachel Dawes admonishes Bruce Wayne.
But it's not who you are underneath. It's what you do that defines you.
Also keep in mind that our vision of our ideal self is not necessarily an expression of absolute perfection. It would be exceptional to find a person who aspires to complete honesty. In a social context, that could appear quite brutal and rude. Instead, the target ideal is a balance that is perceived differently by different individuals. Who's to say what balance is right or wrong? It's best not to judge, not to make someone wrong for where they've chosen to draw that line. The validation of others forms a tremendous pressure to take on a particular role, not necessarily a role we would choose without those pressures. One of the best-known victims of the pressure of family and job is Hamlet. In Act 1, Scene 3, Laertes is counseling his sister Ophelia on the forces that compel Hamlet to be something other than he might want to be.
But you must fear his greatness weighed, his will is not his own, for he himself is subject to his birth. He may not, as unvalued persons do, carve for himself, for on his choice depends the safety and the health of this whole state.
As Hamlet was born into royalty, he is compelled to act in the interests of the state, not necessarily his own interests. He cannot be who he would choose to be, like commoners apparently can. Our self-concept includes more than our delusional superiority, or sadly for some, inferiority. It also includes a vision of possible selves, the Walter Mitty within us. These visions represent our ideas of what we might become, what we would like to become, or what we are afraid of becoming. They're formed from hopes, fears, expectations, and threats. Will you grow up to be like your parents? Does that idea frighten you or inspire you? The psychologist Carl Rogers wrote that everyone is seeking a positive self-concept. He said that everyone is trying to get from their real self to their ideal self, and the closer someone is to that ideal self, the happier the person will be. If we can surrender our judgments, there's so much less to struggle with. Our need for validation shapes our ambitions. As a member of a group which we have chosen, a circle of friends, or been compelled into, family, job, school, a particular behavior is expected of us. That creates a powerful pressure to adopt a conforming role. Our level of comfort with that role depends on how well that group's judgments align with our own. Where there is little alignment, we're unhappy with the role and may reject the group. In the 1999 film The Iron Giant, Hogarth complains of the role his schoolmates expect of him, and Dean advises,
"Who cares what these creeps think, you know? They don't decide who you are, you do. You are who you choose to be."
Rejecting that role means being rejected for nonconformance. There is a loss of self-worth when we lose the acceptance, the validation of the group. Later, the Iron Giant must choose a role in conflict with what he believes was his purpose.
You are who you choose to be.
By asserting a role that is closer to his ideal self-concept, Superman, he gains self-respect and peace of mind. That self-validation is considerably more important than what we get from others. Remember the advice of Polonius in Hamlet, Act 1, Scene 3.
To thine own self be true.
This is often quoted as good advice in choosing the role we play. We can only be happy when the choice aligns with our self-concept and not that of outside forces. Although a valuable lesson, the interpretation is not strictly what Shakespeare likely intended when he wrote it. The actual meaning relates to money. To be true meant to look after yourself first, don't borrow. To be false was to be indebted. The full quote,
"To thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man."
Meaning you cannot be indebted to him. Even with this understanding, we can still relate it to identity. That if we borrow value, validation, from another, then we're dependent on that other for our sense of self-worth. Life is a hopefully long passage, with some struggles and some smooth going. The struggles are usually associated with managing change and growth, shifting ground where we have rooted our identity. It is that change that we either fear, invalidation, or strive for, our ideal self. Finding yourself is really an exercise in surrendering yourself. Letting go of the judgments that compose your identity allows you to find connectedness that brings you peace, love, and joy. Returning to Hamlet, Act 4, Scene 5, Ophelia is descending into madness.
Oh, Lord, we know what we are, but know not what we may be.
We cannot say what events will arise to shape new judgments and sculpt new identities for us. I'd like to think that I can develop skills to control the chisel and hammer out something that comes closer to the ideal that hides within that block of stone. But all that chipping away bits of ourself is really hard to do. It hurts. Good luck. The Orb is a listener-supported presentation of Cornoble Productions. New podcasts are released alternate Mondays at orbcast.ca or pick us up at iTunes. I'm Reed Hart.